You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Due to their largely vegetarian diet and high activity level, Kirin's are virtually always slender. But the travelers looked in wonder upon this woman. She was the thinnest and most wizened Kirin they had ever seen. But she inspected the two foreigners, her eyes sparkling and seeming to dance with curiosity. Wearing a garment of pale green, as did everyone of this tribe the travelers had seen, she was surrounded by attendants.
"May I introduce Lanara," said Issar respectfully, "good queen of the Shillitoes." He turned to her. "May I present the voyagers, whose companions lie in our Farinin?"
"Welcome to our cave," rasped the old queen. "Where did your trek begin, and what is your purpose?"
Deliani marveled at her voice. Issar's was piercing. She didn't know whether that was peculiar to him or characteristic for the tribe, but the queen's was entirely different. It seemed old, as ancient as she looked, and was coarse and gravelly, but somehow it was gentle. Eyeing the attendants, Deliani wondered about their voices. Spekeren responded to the queen's questions. She listened with rapt attention as he told of the home clans, their existence in revered trees and a forest of plenty, and how far the party had traveled.
"Few Kirin's journey as far as you have," she said, "and even fewer pass through this region."
But when Spekeren began discussing the nature of the quest, she was visibly moved. The sparkle in her eyes vanished, and what little color was in her face drained away. She raised a shriveled hand to stop him, but offered no explanation why, greatly arousing his curiosity.
"Rest and recover your strength," she said, "for you will need it. When you are refreshed, we will talk again."
Issar touched her wrinkled right foot with his. "The gesture is the same as ours," noted Deliani. Leaving the ancient queen, Issar led the travelers back down the wall. On the way, they talked about the cave, the Shillitoe tribe, and Hutt's amazing rescue. A third of the way down, they took a horizontal ramp to a special corridor and entered it. Along it were guest chambers, carved from the stone surrounding the cave. Deliani and Spekeren were shown to rooms where they could finally rest. Food and fresh garments were already there, and attendants waited quietly in the hallway while their guests prepared for sleep. Reclining on a soft bed, Deliani thought about Issar's description of Hutt's rescue as they were descending the wall. As Spekeren had earlier, she found it interesting, almost amusing, that he used the word "it" when referring to Lisam. Kirin's of the home clans would use she or her. It might be a difference in the use of language, she thought, or that these strangers aren't familiar with Bird Island. I'll listen closely to their words. It might help gain an insight into their culture, which is substantially different from ours. In his room, the old magician reclined and closed his tired eyes. But it was soon apparent he wouldn't rest until he had seen his two youngsters. He left the room, asked Deliani to accompany him, and an attendant escorted them to the Farinin. It was similar to the queen's throne room, but smaller. Hutt and Tali rested on beds near the entrance, both unconscious, now in green Farinin garments. The visitors were introduced to Lydor, the Farinor, and several helpers. Lydor wore a long green gown, darker than the apparel of other tribe members and similar to Spekeren's in style. The Farinar was delighted to meet a fellow magician, and they discussed plans for the youths. Hutt, they knew, would awaken unharmed. Tali's heiress was their concern, and she showed no sign of recovery. Lydor's voice was smooth and pleasing, almost enchanting, like a song spoken rather than sung. Indeed, every other Shillitoe the visitors were to encounter had voices similar to Lydor's, though not as captivating. The silky sound became so commonplace that the travelers soon got used to it. The queen's voice was the only raspy one, doubtless because of age, and no one else spoke like Issar. Listening to Lydor, Deliani wondered how her voice sounded to them. But the Farinar was addressing the visitors, and she concentrated on his meaning, trying to ignore the sound, so enticing and distracting was it to her ear. "In our part of the world," he was saying, or almost singing, "barwood essence is the most potent material we have to feed the flame of Eris. Essence is the result of distilling raw sap. After its extraction from the tree, however, the sap's properties decay rapidly. Within a few days, it loses its effect entirely. Therefore, we make no attempt to preserve it or keep it on hand." Then he revealed something amazing and unknown to the visitors. "The roots of all trees in a barwood grove are intertwined and interconnected. If one tree is injured, all are injured, and respond as though each one's been violated. Blossoms of a golden hue, latent and apparently awaiting such an incident, appear within a day, even half a day, adorning the boughs of every tree. Our trees have already begun to exhibit this. Issar reports that flowers were beginning to appear when he was leaving the grove this morning. Blended with the rust-brown leaves, it's a stunningly beautiful phenomenon, but also deadly. The blossoms perfuse the air with injurious fumes, making it impossible to enter the grove for weeks." Speckerin had a jarring thought. No more sap could be harvested in time to save Tally. Suddenly he wondered something. Could Hutt have procured sap after all? Through the trials of the past day, no one had determined that. He spoke urgently. "Among our lad's belongings, did you find a silver box and vial?" "It's customary," said Lydor, "to get rid of the clothing and possessions of anyone affected by barwood sap. It must be altered from its raw state before being used therapeutically, or it will only cause harm. In its raw liquid form, we know how to modify it, but we have no means of altering it in trace amounts or garments, and therefore his belongings were cast into the stream. I have instructed our tailors to make him a new set of clothes. They will be ready..."
"Who cast them in and where?" asked Speckerin earnestly.
An assistant stepped forward. "I did, but I don't think you'll find anything. I watched the garments float away until they departed the cave under the shelf of rock. If you like, I'll take you to where I threw them in."
"Please do so now," said the magician.
The attendant led Speckerin, Deliani, and Lydor hurriedly down the wall and across the cave's floor to the edge of the stream. "I threw them in there," said the helper, pointing. Holding up his gown, Speckerin waded out intently, Deliani following. They searched the rocky bottom for some time, but to no avail. Greatly disappointed, they climbed back out. Staring downstream, Speckerin set off in that direction, gazing into the moving water, trying to see anything at the bottom that might have fallen out of Hutt's clothing. The others followed, searching also, the party going all the way to the rocky shelf where the stream exited the cave, but saw nothing. Turning around, they proceeded back to where they had started, searching again, finding nothing. Disheartened, they were starting to make their way toward the wall when Speckerin caught sight of a small boy sitting on the bank a short distance upstream. He was examining a small silver object in his lap, and his inquiring little hands were starting to remove the cap. Chapter 28.
"Stop!" cried Speckerin.
The startled child turned toward him, and the silver vial tumbled to the ground. The lad froze as a delegation led by the foreign magician hastened toward him. Reaching down, Speckerin picked up the vial and examined it. It was closed, but he gave the cap a turn, sealing the small container as tightly as he could.
"I gave this to Hutt yesterday to take to the Barwood Grove," he told Lydor. "If he did succeed before being overcome, it might contain the raw liquor."
"We must take it to the Farrenin," said Lydor, "and open it with utmost precaution."
"Where did you find it?" Speckeren asked the child.
"Where the clothes were thrown in," he said, pointing downstream. "I saw it while I was swimming, glittering at the bottom, caught between rocks. I swam down and picked it up."
Speckeren said to Lydor, "It did fall out of Hutt's things. How lucky we are. Now, if only it contains sap." He turned to the lad. "Did you find a silver box?"
The boy looked down and was quiet. Then he glanced at the visiting magician, stood up, and walked slowly toward a pile of stones near the water. Glancing again at Speckeren, he reached down and brought the box out from behind the stones.
"Have you opened it?" asked Speckeren.
The lad shook his head.
"I'm glad of that, but I'm afraid you must give it up, too."
The boy ambled back and handed it to him.
"Good lad. You might have saved a girl's life. What's your name?"
"Lindor," said the boy.
Noting the similarity in names, Speckeren looked at Lydor.
"My grandson," said the Farrenor.
"He must be rewarded," said Speckeren. "These objects came from my bag. I'll find something else in it for him. But now we must hasten. Tally awaits our help."
Accompanied by the child, the group hurried up the wall to the Farrenin. Speckeren handed the vial to Lydor.
"Please open this, and if sap is found, prepare it."
"I'm honored," said the Farrenor, bowing and accepting the container.
"This box might contain barwood leaves," said Speckeren, holding it out.
"Keep it," said Lydor, to the old magician's surprise. "The leaves have different properties than the sap. They'd probably not help in this situation."
Speckeren slid the box into his bag.
"I thought the leaves were important, too. I hope this Farrenor knows more than I about barwood trees."
Deliani stayed with the two unconscious youths while Lydor, Speckeren, Lindor, and three Farrenin helpers went to a work area brightly illuminated by torches at the back of the cavern. A long workbench, not unlike Speckeren's at home, was against the wall. The bench's surface was entirely covered with instruments of healing and magic. Jars, boxes, and other containers of various colors, sizes, and shapes. Most of the objects were foreign to Speckeren. Against the rock wall was a large wooden door hinged at its bottom. The hinges were at the level of the bench. Speckeren chuckled as Lydor and his assistants busied themselves clearing all the paraphernalia from the central part of the bench.
"The Farrenor's workbench," thought the old magician, "is no neater than mine, and in fact is more cluttered."
The healer unlatched the door at its top and swung it down, dust and debris falling liberally, until the door rested on and covered the area of the bench that had been cleared. Brushing bits of stone off the door, the workbench, and his gown, he grinned sheepishly at Speckeren.
"We haven't used this shaft for a long while."
Speckeren immediately sensed a draft moving through the space and out the opening, and the torches suddenly burned brighter.
"It opens to the outside world," said Lydor, "removing all noxious and hazardous vapors from the Farrenin. When working with volatile materials like barwood sap, such ventilation is mandatory. We are fortunate Lindor didn't open the vial, assuming sap is inside."
Lydor moved several odd-looking objects from one side of the bench onto the door's surface. Then he appeared to be trying to arrange them into some sort of apparatus, his assistants standing quietly by. After struggling for some time, he turned, beads of sweat on his forehead, and asked two for help. He grinned again at Speckeren.
"We haven't used this for a long while, either."
He had thick hair in front, but as he went back to work, Speckeren noticed a small bald spot in back. With whispering and disagreement as they worked, the three did apparently complete the assembly and stood back to admire it. The Farrenor wiped his brow.
We are ready to open the container.
The third assistant, who was guarding it carefully, handed it to Lidor. Holding it over the bench in front of the vent, he slowly removed the cap. He peered inside the tube, cautiously sniffed the contents, and turned to the others.
We have barwood sap, he announced to everyone's relief. We will begin the process of taming it.
He slowly turned the vial upside down over the assembled apparatus, then waited. After what seemed an interminable time, a single drop of thick fluid fell into a green funnel atop the complex arrangement. Then another drop, and several more, were directed carefully into the funnel. The liquor was collecting below in a copper receptacle. When no more was forthcoming, Lidor recapped the vial and placed it on the bench. He removed the funnel, and Speckron could now see it was a leaf curled into the shape of a funnel. Lidor handed it to an assistant for disposal, then placed a tightly fitting lid over the receptacle holding the liquor. The Feranor then picked up a colorful object Speckron recognized as a fire starter. The healer said a word, and blue flame burst from its tip.
"Lights a lot quicker than mine did in the woods," chuckled Speckron, "but his isn't drenched with rainwater."
The Feranor touched the flame to an under portion of the apparatus. It lit immediately, and fire jumped to several other areas. A low moan began emanating from the contrivance. Metal tubes and vessels appeared to be warming, and the sound was building. Moving to Speckeren's side, Lidor raised his voice.
"The essence will be separated from the injurious dregs of the liquor. But this is hardly an exact science. Mishaps have occurred, and we won't know whether the yield will be effective until it is administered."
Speckeren wasn't an expert in this area, and these revelations surprised and bothered him. The noise continued to swell, and Lidor spoke again, his mouth close to Speckeren's ear.
"There is nothing more you can see or do here until the distillation is complete. It will take time, perhaps a day or more, and there's no way to hurry it. You would better serve your charges and yourself by getting some well-deserved rest."
The mention of rest made the old magician stop and allow himself to feel what had been building inside, fatigue so heavy it was almost a palpable weight. And the growing noise was a painful reminder of the clamor in his brain when the Granum intruded through the Calamar, and he was now very uncomfortable. Nodding to Lidor, he turned away from the heating engine and its whine and proceeded to the front of the cavern, the boy Lindor following, his hands over his ears. At last, Deliani had welcome news for Speckeren. "One of our young friends might soon be back among us." The old magician leaned over and peered at Tally, then Hutt. At first he saw no change in either. Then he did. Hutt was lying on his side, and his eyelids fluttered, then began to open. But his eyes appeared blank and unseeing. Closing them again, he stretched and yawned, and the semblance of a smile crossed his face. Then he relaxed and seemed to be falling asleep again.
"Wake up, little one," called Speckeren, shaking him by the shoulder, trying to be heard above the engine's infernal noise.
The lad responded by turning onto his other side, but with prodding he opened his eyes again, then sat up and swung his feet over the edge of the bed.
"What a dream that was," he said with a teasing grin. He turned toward the energizing engine. "What's that?"
He stretched and yawned and shook his head as if trying to clear the cobwebs. Then he pointed over his shoulder toward the noise.
"Oh, never mind that. What I meant to say is, what's for breakfast? I've never been so hungry in my life."
The two senior travelers were so moved at having one of their youths back that they found it hard to speak. Deliani wanted to welcome him as if he had been far away for a long time, which in a way he had. They had been assured he would recover, but it wasn't until he did that she could relax her vigil for him. But it was hardly complete relief, because Tally lay awaiting the capricious essence. Hutt was helped to his feet, Spekeren, Deliani, and an assistant from the Farinen then leading him onto the terrace, where there was comparative peace and quiet.
"What a relief to be outside," said Spekeren, "and away from that din. Let's take Hutt to the guest chambers."
With Deliani escorting the lad, they began descending a stairway.
"We're not outside at all," said a tottering Hutt, staring about at the huge, brightly lighted cave. "Where are we?"
And from then on, it was all the three adults could do to keep the amazed lad's attention on where he was going. With one in front and two at his sides, the party descended haltingly, Lindor trailing. Wearing green Farinen pajamas, the unsteady, wide-eyed Hutt moved at his own pace and in the direction he chose. Leaning in whatever direction he was looking, his gaze ranged throughout the cave, Spekeren and Deliani quickly learning that escorting their blissful companion down the incline was as harrowing as anything they had done during their quest. At one point, where a tunnel opened on the left and the narrow path proceeded ahead, Hutt lurched to the right and was stepping over the precipice when Deliani threw her arms about his waist, brought him back, and edged him into the passageway for a respite. Finally arriving at the tunnel leading to the guest chambers, they pushed Hutt inside and ushered him to Spekeren's room, where they closed the door and insisted he remain there instead of exploring the cave as he wished. Attendants brought a meal of honey, wild blueberries, and an unusually delicate mushroom with a very long stem. The guests ate around a small table, while Lindor sat on the floor. Hutt ate especially ravenously and appeared to be recovering steadily. Deliani told him everything that had happened since his visit to the Barwood Grove, and he was astonished. An attendant brought two silver goblets containing a drink for Deliani and Spekeren. Supplied by Lydor, it was an elixir extracted from a local fruit, which, by its description, was unknown in the home forest. The drink was delicious and soothing, and soon they were ready for sleep. Hutt, on the other hand, had just slept for a day and was ready for action. Demonstrating his alertness by prancing about the room, he insisted he was recovered. Spekeren and Deliani decided that, if Lindor went with him, it would be safe for him to explore.
"But are you going in that outfit?"
Spekeren asked Hutt. The lad looked down at his green pajamas.
"Sure, why not?"
Deliani smiled. "I don't think his Barwood days has quite worn off," she thought, "but how wonderful to have him back."
"They're making you a new set of clothes," said the magician. "I hope they're finished soon."
"I wonder what they'll be like," said Deliani.
"I can't just sit in my room till then," said Hutt, motioning to Lindor. "Come on, let's go."
The lads departed cheerfully. Deliani retired to her chamber, and Spekeren was at last alone. Sitting down on the bed, he quietly took stock of his party.
"Deliani and I are spent, but with rest should recover. Before the Shillitoes delivered Hutt, I was more dispirited than ever in my lifetime, but things have lightened markedly. Problems that seemed insurmountable are being resolved. Hutt has returned, and there's hope for Tali."
He had not had time to think of Jilin for a long while. Thinking of him now, a cold and hollow feeling invaded his heart. He closed his eyes and shook his head. "His invisibility, our losing him, it's all out of my hands now." He reclined on his soft bed. "Jilin is probably home," he reassured himself. As he drifted off to sleep, he dreamed of the home clans, welcoming the lad lovingly into their midst. Had he known what had actually befallen Jilin, his dream would have been a nightmare.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirin's, visit www.kirinbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.